with the police banging on the door. Open up.
The choice to be in that lineup was the last choice I made as a free man.
A year later, I ended up right in the system.
I'm going to be one of those people who everyone in the world is going to think is a monster or suspect is a monster for the rest of my life, and I'm just going to have to come to peace with that.
Somebody was able to look at my picture in a database and say that I was somewhere where I definitely wasn't.
I overheard three of the jailers discussing what part they might have to play in my hanging. They had been told that two prison officers would have to participate in my execution.
And I walked back inside that prison for the last time, man. All hell broke loose, man.
Welcome back to Wrongful Conviction with Jason Flom. Today we have a very special episode, not only because of our amazing guest, Dennis Mayer. First of all, Dennis, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Dennis, we'll get into his story in a minute, but let's suffice it to say that he was a sergeant in the United States Army when he was wrongfully convicted of three rapes and served almost 20 years in prison. I also want to introduce Hannah Riley, who's the Director of Communications for the New England Innocence Project. And she's a first time on the show, hopefully not the last.
Right.
And then we have a very close friend of mine, Alex Spiro. He is a former criminal prosecutor in New York and currently a defense attorney. He's also a professor at Harvard Law School. Alex, it's great to have you on the show as well.
Thanks.
So, Dennis, let's start with you. Your case is of great interest, I think, to anyone who's interested in this genre because it touches on a number of really important and tragically common problems in the wrongful conviction world. The mistaken eyewitness identification is unique in your case because of the fact that there were three different women who identified you under dubious circumstances, but nonetheless they identified you. It touches on the storage of evidence because in your case the evidence had been supposedly lost, but actually it wasn't. And that's something that is really disturbing to anyone who's interested in justice. It deals with incompetent defense counsel. Mm-hmm. And also it also has an element of willful wrongful prosecution. So you really hit the jackpot of causes of getting locked up for something you didn't do. So let's go back, and this is a while ago, right? We're talking 1983 when this all came down.
That's when it started, yeah.
So 1983, paint a picture for us. Were you active duty in the military at this time?
Yes, I was stationed at Fort Devens.
Right, and you had been in the airborne, right?
I was a paratrooper, yeah.
Paratrooper stationed in Italy.
Well, first it was at Fort Bragg, then I volunteered to serve overseas, then I re-enlisted to come home to Massachusetts, and then I got off a jump status to work in my field, which was a diesel mechanic.
And that's another thing. It's really upsetting to me as someone who loves this country and respects the men and women of our military. Here you are. You're 23 years old at the time?
Yep.
And what happened? Let's go back to that.
Well, I graduated from high school in 78 and enlisted in the Army right out of high school. You know, I went through basic training, advanced individual training, jump school, then went to Fort Bragg, then to Vicenza, Italy in the 509th, and then to 10th Special Forces up at Fort Devens. Then I got off a jump status to work as a diesel mechanic because what I worked on doesn't drop out of planes. And then from there, I was living at home in Lowell with my parents. I was walking down Westford Street, and I was stopped by the police. They asked me for identification, so I gave them my driver's license, which was outdated because when you're in the military, you get a card on the back of it that says your license never expires. And so, well, they asked me for identification. They ran my name, which came back negative because I'd never been in trouble. No speeding tickets, no nothing. He gave me back my ID, and then he searched me, and he arrested me for possession of marijuana. So they brought me to the police station and booked me and put me in a holding cell. A couple of hours later, they came out and questioned me. And they said, where were you on the night of November 16 at 5:30? Well, I said, I was in my CO's office getting yelled at because we failed a nuclear biological chemical test. And I didn't leave the base till almost 5:15. So I didn't get home till almost 6 o'clock. And then he put me back in the cell. And then the other cop come in a couple of hours later and asked me the same questions. I gave him the same answers. On the night of November 17th, I left the base early to get my car inspected, and I went home and took a nap, and then I went over to my friend's house to watch the Bruins game. And then they brought me into court the next day and arraigned me for possession of marijuana. And then they did what's called an in-court identification. They took me out of the box and sat me on the bench, and they brought one of the victims in, and she identified someone else.
Wait, did you even know what was going on at this point? I mean, you were being booked for possession of marijuana, but now they're bringing in a victim. There's no victim of possession of marijuana.
True. What I missed was the second time they started questioning me, I got mad. You know, why? What are you questioning me about? And he said, well, we're questioning you about a rape that happened on November 16th and an attempted rape that happened on November 17th. So I said, well, I guess I need a lawyer. And then the next day in court, they did an in-court identification. Now, I was never arraigned for the rapes or anything. They just did an in-court identification. And the victim ID'd someone else, and the judge said, you have no grounds to go forward.
Well, so, seems like case closed right there. I mean,
so they gave me 6 months probation and said I could leave. Now, they had my boots, so I was in stocking feet and going to have to walk home in stocking feet. As I was leaving the courtroom, they arrested me and charged me with the rape and the attempted rape that the judge said there was no grounds to go forward on.
Okay, Alex, do you want to jump in here? Because this whole story is pretty surreal, right? First of all, the thing with the boots, we'll get back to that. Like, why they're making you walk home. And this is in, it's cold outside. It's Massachusetts.
November. Yeah.
November, yeah, walking home. Okay, well, that's a little surreal. Then you've just spent the night in jail for the first time in your life, so I'm sure you're a little whacked out anyway at that point. What's going on here, Alex? Can you get into this?
I mean, obviously the use of that sort of identification procedure raises serious questions, because just presenting him alone or him in that sort of a setting when he's already being accused of some other crime is not the right way to conduct, I think we know now, identification procedures. But I guess what must have happened is twofold. One, no doubt that the members of law enforcement were under pressure to make an arrest in this case. And secondarily, during the time in which Mr. Mayer was incarcerated on the initial charge, I'm sure that they noticed things, articles of clothing, putting him near the scene, and other indicia that they believed to be corroboration. And so the lack of identification obviously did not set this record straight.
Right. And there's a very interesting point that you touch on there, which is that there was one of the victims had said that the attacker had a red hooded sweatshirt, right? And that became one of the only sort of circumstantial pieces of evidence that was even something that they could put a hook on, right?
That's why I think they stopped me, because they saw I was wearing a red hooded sweatshirt. You know, and they were 200 feet away from me, and they said I fit the artist conception, but I believe it was just I had a red hooded sweatshirt on.
Right, so 7 o'clock at night, 200 feet away, it's pretty hard to decide. I mean, you'd have to have sort of like really superhuman vision to be able to match a suspect at night, 7 o'clock in November, in Massachusetts. I'm not a meteorologist, but I'm guessing it was dark.
Yes,
and
it was.
So it was dark, and you were 200 feet away, and they managed to magically figure out that it was you. Now, this goes back to the thing I talk about often, which is that this is a small town, right? You have a rapist out there who's just attacked two women, raped one of them, sexually assaulted, and attempted to rape the other one. They got to find somebody. There you are walking around in a red hooded sweatshirt. It's like, oh, bingo, this is great. We can get this off our desks to an extent, right? And so, Alex, go back to what you were saying before.
Yeah, I mean, obviously we don't know sort of verbatim the back and forth, but no, that is not a sound identification procedure. I can say that quite assuredly.
And at what point did you had requested a lawyer. At what point did you get assigned a lawyer?
A lawyer approached my parents and asked if he could represent me. Now, this is the lawyer who ended up representing me at trial. He approached my parents the same day. I had one appointed to me for possession. You know, I got 6 months probation. But then another lawyer approached my parents asking if he could represent me.
And they said yes.
Yes, because they knew nothing about the law like me. You know, they'd never been in trouble or anything. And he said he'd represent me for $5,000 on a rape case.
Now, 1983, $5,000, $5,000, right? I mean, that's a lot of money back then. So you would hope that this guy would be a real star. But that's not the way it worked out at all, is it? Back to the scene. So now you're about to walk home in your socks, or stocking feet, as New Englanders call it. And then you get pulled back in and you get charged with two counts of, well...
rape and an attempted rape.
Right.
Well, I didn't get charged then. They just arrested me. And then they took me back to the police station and kept me in the station over the weekend and brought me into Cambridge Courthouse, and that's where they charged me with rape and put me on $10,000 bail, which is $1,000 cash. So my parents bailed me out, and then I went to the first lineup, which was me, six police officers. They were all standing behind a railing. I was standing behind a chair, and I was ID'd. That was the first one.
That's that kind of stuff always blows me away. Let's just reflect back on that. So they were standing behind a railing, and you were standing behind a chair. So there was really no reason that anyone would think there'd be anything different about you, right? And there were six police officers and you. Okay. And then the victim, one of the victims comes in.
And identified me, you know, it was probably obvious to her, you know, I'm standing behind a chair. I really don't remember the second lineup, but I think it went along the same lines. It was me, six police officers, my brother, and this time I wasn't standing behind a chair, and she ID'd me.
What does your brother have to do with it?
Well, he was just in the line. He was there, and they just wanted to stick him in the lineup.
That seems odd, doesn't it?
Alex, well, have you heard of that? I think that, you know, law enforcement would say that later they can assert that they did everything in their power to find people that look like him and who looks more like a person than their own brother.
And that's an interesting thing, too, because eyewitness identification, as everyone who listens to the show knows, is the leading cause of wrongful conviction.
Yes, it is.
And what we also know is that in cases where there's a weapon involved and someone is in close proximity and really fearing for their life in a very real way, the incidence of mistaken identification goes up. And that's logical, right, as an amateur psychologist. If you're freaking out, and literally like your adrenaline is on, you know, 10, you know, your mind's not going to function in the way that it would if you were just calmly sitting here and just look at somebody. But when someone's got a knife to your throat and is either raping or attempting to rape you, your faculties are not going to be operating in a normal fashion, to say the least. And so this case had that as well, because the victims were in that exact situation.
Have you seen the gorilla basketball video?
Yes.
Okay.
Have you guys seen that?
Mm-hmm.
So the idea being we just aren't able to focus really clearly on a lot of things at once. So if you haven't seen this, I'm completely going to ruin it for you, but...
No, just watch it. Everyone should watch it.
Right. Google. It's on YouTube. It's There's a selective attention test.
Right. There's a selective attention test. It involves a basketball. Yes. I strongly recommend that everybody listening to the show watch this because it'll give you an idea of just how easy it is for your mind to play tricks on you. So let's go back to the scene, right? So you end up now with this high-priced, fancy lawyer, right? And you didn't get what you paid for.
No, I didn't. He never visited where the crime happened. He never interrogated witnesses or talked to the witnesses or anything like that. We went to trial and... March of 2004. Well, before that, January 5th, 1984, the police came and arrested me again and brought me down to the police station. I said, well, what are you arresting me for? They wouldn't say anything. And they handed me over to the Ayer Police Department. So they brought me back to Ayer. And on the way, I asked the cop, you know, what am I under arrest for? She said, just shut up. So I asked her again, and she said, just shut up. I says, can you please tell me what I'm under arrest for? And she said, well, you're under arrest for a rape that happened at the Casa Mano Hotel. I said, where's the Casa Mano Hotel? Because I never knew where it was until 2 years ago when I went and spoke in Ayer. And she said, well, you committed a rape there. I said, no, I didn't. And then they brought me in Ayer and put my bail at $50,000 cash. So that was my last day of freedom, was January 5th, 1984. And then we went through another lineup, and I was ID'd again. And in March of 1984, we went to trial.
Going back to your lawyer, so your lawyer didn't visit the crime scene. Big red flag there.
Yeah.
Didn't interview the witnesses. That seems even more insane. Okay. What else did he forget to do, or neglect to do, I should say?
He didn't show up for some hearings. At the trial, he presented most of the case for the prosecutor. You know, he's standing next to me. Are you sure this is the person? Are you sure this? And pointing at me saying, are you sure this is the person who raped you? And of course, I got found guilty.
I mean, he might as well just say, are you sure that this rapist is the one who raped you, right? I mean, it's like, I mean, it's crazy. It's so, it's incomprehensible. I mean, Alex, jump in here because I'm freaking out.
Yeah, this is not, does not sound like good lawyering. I'll tell you that.
Now, let's talk about what good lawyering might have looked like, because this is an unusual situation we have here where we actually have somebody on the show who can give us that type of idea.
I guess I'd break it down into two parts. In terms of the identification, I think you have to remember that in terms of Lowell, the women were approached from behind. You already mentioned the distraction of a weapon, a high tense situation affecting the ability to accurately picture somebody and recall it. For one, she had already seen the individual that she would later pick out because she had seen him in a courtroom setting on a bench. And so even if she just remembered that, she would falsely identify him. It also wasn't a double-blind procedure, meaning that the investigator ostensibly knew who she was trying to pick out, put him in a unique setting within the lineup, and everything else. In addition, all of the witnesses were shown photographs in which they identified, as I understand it, Mr. Mayor, before they viewed a live lineup. And so what often happens is that you end up picking out the person that you saw in the photo array, not necessarily the person you saw on the night in question. And sort of all of that coupled with law enforcement's desire from perhaps a very good place of trying to solve this crime can lead to a series of identification procedures not being pristine and not being correctly done. And the taint from one bleeds over into the next, because once he's identified in these initial cases, the air case becomes a foregone conclusion. And I think you have to attack that in all of those different ways. I also think they used corroborative evidence that is a bit of a red herring. They see him in the vicinity near the time of the initial rapes in Lowell, but the truth is he's from that area. It's not like finding somebody in some remote location or finding somebody far away from where they normally travel. They see a knife and a jacket in his car, but that's military-issued wear that most of the men in his age demographic in a military town might very well have. And he might be wearing a red sweatshirt, but as us folks from Boston know, a lot of the sports teams there have red sweatshirts, and I don't think that is that unique of an item. And so there were all of those things that needed to be investigated. And on top of that, he had an alibi that wasn't properly vetted, that could have been properly vetted, that would suggest he couldn't have been where they say that he was. And the crimes themselves, the air crime versus the Lowell crimes, don't have the same fact pattern and don't necessarily suggest that the same person perpetrated them. And that wasn't really tested or explored. And I think that could have been used effectively to suggest law enforcement's tunnel vision.
Were any of these factors brought up by your attorney at trial or at any other time?
Well, he brought up part of my alibi because where I was at the base for the November 16th crime, and they just dismissed it. They said, do you have that in writing? Even though I had NCOs there, sergeants there testifying on my behalf, that they were with me.
So the sergeants actually testified at trial and mm-hmm. said that you were there?
Yeah.
Now, those would seem to be relatively, we're not talking about crackheads, right? We're talking about sergeants in the United States Army mm-hmm. who are saying, this guy was here. Again, I'm not a professor of metaphysics, but you can't be in two places at one time. Everybody knows that.
And the sergeants had a reason to remember, right? The sergeant said that there had been a test failure and that it was an intense meeting. And so it wasn't a standard meeting. It was a meeting that they would have, one would think, remember. And they remembered him there.
Yeah, that's an excellent point, again, that a good defense lawyer would have brought up. And this is very different than some of the cases we see where a guy's alibi or a woman's alibi is that they were home with their parents watching TV or with their wife or something. And then they say, wow, they'll lie for it. Anybody would lie to protect their family. This is not family. Right. These guys are not your uncles or
no.
brothers or anything else. I mean, these are guys you work with.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, they were pissed at you at this particular time on top of that. So that's just nuts.
I think what the prosecutor may have countered is even if they were to be believed, he still had enough time from 5:15 to 5:30 to make it to the scene. But of course, if you did your job and you did an investigation, you would drive a car from one location to another. And you would show what the traffic patterns were at that time and show that it was feasibly impossible. And so there was a way to draw that out and tighten up that alibi that it does not appear was done.
Well, yeah, I mean, and we also don't know how long that meeting went on for, but how long would it have taken you? Even if you had left immediately, you had to walk to get to your car. Mm-hmm. You would have had to drive off the base. I imagine there's some elapsed time there. And then how long would it have taken you on a typical day to drive from there to where the rape occurred?
Probably half hour to 45 minutes.
Case closed, right? I mean, that just doesn't match, Your Honor. He wasn't there because he was somewhere else.
One of the things is, you know, he was arrested so close in time, it's much easier to figure out where you were since you were arrested within 48 hours of when the accusation was, right? So the sergeant's memories would have also been sharp. If he was arrested 2 or 3 years later, one could say you don't really remember where you were on the night of November 15th or 16th. But because it happened so close afterwards, he really did have an independent memory, and so did the other individuals that were interviewed.
Alex brings up a very good point, which is that it's contemporaneous. It's like, right now, this is what happened. This is where you were. You should be out of there at that moment in time with any sort of competent defense. What about the prosecutor at that point? I mean, how does a prosecutor, having been a prosecutor, you obviously have insight that nobody else that's ever been on this show does. What is it that causes a prosecutor to continue to prosecute somebody and ultimately lock them up or sentence them to death when they have real hard evidence that it wasn't the guy?
Well, the notion that they had hard evidence may be a bit of an overstatement. I guess this is why you need to have a strong defense, because what the prosecutor's seeing is multiple identifications and seeing evidence that's corroborative put before him, right? And we went through the identification and we went through the corroboration, and when you peel away at it, it doesn't seem as strong. Now, what did he make of the alibi witnesses? I have a feeling that he probably thought to himself, well, if he left it, if he knew he was going to be at that meeting and he knew that the meeting was over at 5-ish, it gave him exactly the right amount of time, not just too little time, but exactly the right amount of time to both have a supposed alibi and to commit the crimes in question. And so he would take facts in the world that you might look through a different lens at, and he would look through them at a lens that he's guilty. I know that he's guilty. So what else proves that he's guilty?
But in this case, as in many other wrongful convictions, there was no physical evidence connecting him to the crime.
But in the 1980s, if you were to commit a crime in the woods, there usually wasn't forensic evidence. So the counter to that would be you wouldn't expect to find forensic evidence outdoors, and you wouldn't expect to find videotape because it's not like New York in 2017, and you wouldn't expect to find DNA because it was prior to the modernization of DNA technology. And so what you have here is exactly what you'd expect to have. You have a woman who is a credible witness who swears under oath that he did it, and you have other factors such as the clothing, the time and place, and the repetition of the events suggesting that he's a good suspect.
Circumstantial, but nonetheless enough to be able, in a prosecutor's mind, to rationalize the continued prosecution or persecution, in this case, of somebody like you. So fast forward to the trial. We know that this attorney mounted a feeble, would be a nice way of putting it, incompetent would probably be a better description of the representation.
Or horrible.
Horrible, yeah, and overpaid. Those are the ways I would describe the defense that you received in this case, which is, again, typical. The only thing that's not typical about it is that most of the people that are wrongfully convicted are represented by public defenders. In this case, you had to pay for the privilege of this guy acting like a prosecutor, which is beyond reprehensible. It's disgusting. Ultimately, the jury goes out. What were you feeling? I mean, how long did they deliberate for?
I think it was like 2 hours, hour and a half, something like that. They didn't deliberate a real long time.
No, that's a very short time. So, again, it's an unimaginable circumstance to anybody on the outside. What did you think when they came back in? Did you think you were going to be exonerated? You knew you were innocent.
I thought I was going to be found guilty because of the way the lawyer represented me. Even though the court office was saying, you're going to get found guilty, I didn't feel that way because my lawyer was so horrible. You know, I had visions of going to prison, being stabbed, being raped, being beat up because it was a sex offense.
And you knew that those, you know, typically those will land you in real hot water once you get on the inside.
Yeah.
So they come back and sure enough, they find you guilty.
I was pissed, you know, and I stood up in the courtroom. Well, after you get found guilty, they ask if you have anything to say. You know, I was a soldier. You know, I was a defender of my country. And they want to say that I did this. So I got up, and after the judge asked if I had anything to say, of course I did. I said, Your Honor, if you call this justice, I think you and your whole judicial system are a crock of shit. And he doubled my sentence to 20 to 30 years.
Wow.
Because the DA years later told me that he was going to give me a 10 to 15. Then I said that, and he said to the clerk, did you sign that yet? And he goes, no. He said, double the sentence.
In front of you?
Yeah.
Holy shit.
I didn't hear him say that, but the DA did. And he told me later on that he heard him tell the clerk to double the sentence.
And we know now that the DA had his own doubts about this, right?
Yes.
And I want to get into the prison experience, but your case is unusual for another reason, which is that you actually ultimately, 20-something years later, received an apology from the person who actually put you in there. It seems like this was a guy, and it's hard to say based on what we've just heard, but it seems like a guy who actually had a conscience. Well, it is a guy who has a conscience. At least he has one now, right? Because he tried to make amends to you, which is impossible to do, but he tried, right? And this was the first case that this guy had tried as a prosecutor, right?
Yeah, I believe it was his first case as a prosecutor.
Right, which is another factor, right, Alex? I mean, as the first case.
Even in the criminal realm, I think for this to be your first case as a prosecutor is a tricky one.
Now you get taken off to prison. Where were you in prison?
The first stop was at MCI Walpole. It's called Cedar Junction now, but it's maximum security. And I went in there to be booked. And then they transferred me from there to Concord. That's where they decide where they're going to send you. Where I had a 20 to 30, I would be behind the walls, because anything over 18 years, you got to do time behind the walls. They call it behind the walls being maximum security.
Right. So on top of the fact that your sentence was doubled, and we know typically in a rape case, you know, 15 years would be the general guideline that I've seen. But because you were trying to stand up for yourself and say something, which after what you'd been through, I guess it's hard to fault you for wanting to actually speak your mind. So this had another negative consequence, not only doubling your sentence, but putting you in a more dangerous and worse in every imaginable way facility than you would have been in otherwise.
Yeah.
So you end up in
Walpole.
Walpole. What can you tell us about that? Because was it as bad as you expected it to be? Was it?
Well, when you first walk into the prison, you go down a long hallway and you go through this big door, and the door slams behind you, and you're in a, it's probably 12 by 12 with a guard up the top with a rifle in his hand, with a shotgun in his hand, until you go through the next, which takes you through the wall and you get into the prison itself. And then as you go into the prison, you could smell the fear in the building. Most prisons strive on fear. You know, fear that, well, someone's going to rape me, someone's going to stab me, and that if I do it first, then no one's going to do it to me. And that's the way prison works, a lot of it. You know, and I was going in there as a sex offender, and I didn't know what was going to happen. I would go walk in the yard and see other people getting beat up that were sex offenders and stuff. And then I was only there a couple of days, and then they took me to Concord, which was less stressful than Walpole. But then when I got my life sentence, I went back to Walpole and was going to end up doing almost a year there. Right before I got back there, there was a riot where they broke through one of the walls. And for orientation, you go in and it's gas. You could smell the gas still in the air from when they had gassed the inmates. And they put me on an Essex block, which was for people who were prone to violence. They broke it down into Essex, Bristol, and Suffolk, which was Essex would be for the ones who really acted up. Bristol would be for the lesser ones, and then Suffolk would be even for lesser than that. So while I was on Essex, I got cut. I got 3 stitches here and 14 stitches across the back of my neck because I was a sex offender. I did really nothing wrong, but that's the way it was. You know, the guy called me down. I was talking to him, and he reached out and grabbed me. I had hair down to my shoulders, and he grabbed me by my hair and pulled me up against the jail bars. And with a razor blade, he cut me hair, and then I ducked down to get out of the way. And he sliced me across the back of the neck. So I went back up into my cell, and I pushed the skin back in. And I reached behind my neck, and my finger went inside. And I says, well, I got to go to the hospital. So I went downstairs, and I said to the CO, I says, yeah, I got to go down to the hospital. He goes, why? I says, I cut myself shaving. He didn't know that I had the cut that was bleeding on the back of my neck. He just knew I had the one here. And so I went down there, and they said, what happened? I said, well, I cut myself shaving. He says, well, we're not going to do anything until you tell us what happened. You know, and I'm saying, you know, I got this huge cut on the back of my neck. So I told him, I says, yeah, the guy cut me. And then he stitched up my face with no anesthesia or nothing. Just I could feel the thread going through my skin and the needle going through my skin. He used anesthesia on the back because it was so long. I did another probably 5 months there, and there were fights all the time, people getting stabbed. Christmas Eve, there was a racial fight on the block between like 10 people. Early in January, there was blacks and the Muslims. They hate each other in prison. And I walk in a chow hall, they run around on the table stabbing each other. And so you just lean up against the wall and hold your steel tray in front of you so that you can't get stabbed. And
the day like a shield.
Yeah. So the day that I was supposed to leave there, there were shots fired in the yard because there was going to be another race riot in the prison. And finally I went to Gardner, which they called Skinner Mountain because all the sex offenders were there. And so there it was less stressful and I could do more things. I started lifting weights. And then while I was there, there was almost another race riot between the blacks and the Puerto Ricans. There was like 150 Puerto Ricans on top of the hill and around the same amount of blacks that were going to fight. They evacuated the prison. Nothing happened, but... And then from there, I went to the treatment center where I got 1 day to natural life civil commitment, which was just people supposedly in treatment. But while there, they brought people from the prison system down, and one of them who was just about ready to get out, I mean, he was going a minimum. He would have been out within 2 months. He brutally raped a woman, and which was horrible, you know, because I worked in a staff kitchen, so I dealt with all the staff, and she was a really nice person.
Oh, he raped someone in the prison?
He raped a staff member in the prison.
Wow.
You know, but in the prison, people would get raped, not all the time, but, you know, at least once or twice a month, someone would get raped by another guy. You know, so I didn't because I lifted. By then, I was benching 350 and squatting 500 pounds, and nobody bothered me, you know, and I treated everyone good. You know, and I kept my job in the staff kitchen so I could eat good. And when I left the staff kitchen, they were disappointed because I was leaving, because who was going to cook for them?
Wow. It takes a minute to process all that. Let's get to the good part of the story, let's call it, right, where things start to turn around.
Well, in 1994, I left work and was heading back to the block. And someone said, Dennis put on the Phil Donahue show. And Barry Scheck was on there. He had like 6 or 7 exonerees at that time. It was either 93 or 94. And he was talking about how he had used DNA to prove their innocence. And I knew the only way that I was going to be proven innocent was through the use of DNA. So my friend Bob Cameron, who has since died, helped me find the address to Yeshiva University and the Cardoza School of Law. And I wrote them a letter asking for help. And I got a 26-page questionnaire back from them, and I filled all that out and sent it back. And I got another questionnaire back, the same thing. I guess they were going to compare it to see if they were both the same, if I was just making up stories. And then I got a letter back from them asking for all my transcripts. Now, you got to imagine, I hadn't had a lawyer since 1985.
9 years earlier.
Yeah. And I wanted to keep things going on in the court. Well, first, my lawyer got disbarred when I was at Walpole. So I had to learn how to do a motion for appointment of counsel and motion for indigency and whatever else I had to do to get an appeals lawyer. So I got an appeals lawyer, and he didn't represent me the way I wanted him to. I wanted him to raise illegal search and seizure because they went and broke into my car and took evidence. But he wouldn't, so he just raised that the two cases shouldn't have been tried together and a bunch of crap. And so I didn't have a lawyer after that, so I learned to file things on my own. I filed Rule 30s and whatever I could. I filed a motion for a paternity test just to see if there was evidence that they could match against me. But everything I ever filed had to go in front of my sentencing judge, who didn't think kindly of me because, you know, I told him him and his whole judicial system were a crock of shit. And he was a former Marine, so I send all the stuff to the Innocence Project, which was probably 1,200 pages of information between appeals and motions and stuff like that. And they start looking for evidence. And they call the police department. They call the courthouse asking for evidence. And they're telling them the evidence is lost. The evidence is destroyed. And this goes on for like 3 years. Because, you know, that the Innocence Project, the students come in and they work on the cases and they try and find the evidence. So in 1997, Barry had an attorney in Boston file a motion for DNA testing in front of my sentencing judge, who denied it without a hearing like he'd denied everything else without a hearing. So at that time, I was hopeless. You know, I made peace with myself that I was going to die in prison as an innocent man. And then out of the blue, a reporter from the Boston Globe named John Elliman asked if he could come interview me. So this is a piece of hope. So I said, yeah, okay, you can interview me. And we started talking about it. And finally I said to him, I said, who sent you? He goes, oh, you know who sent me. I says, no, I don't. And he says, well, I was at Boston Superior Court. And I saw J.W. Carney. Now, this is the person who prosecuted me back in 1984. And I said, Jay, you know, give me someone to do an article on. He goes, now, at this time, Jay was a private attorney. And he had represented the guy who shot up an abortion clinic in Boston and another guy who killed his wife. And he says, I'll tell you what. If I believe this is right and you do the article on this guy, you may get a Pulitzer Prize out of it. So he sent him to interview me. And so we were talking, and he says, here's a piece of news I'm going to give you. Your judge is retiring in 6 months. The day he retired, I called the New York Innocence Project and asked if they could help me again. And he said, I really shouldn't take this phone call, but I will. What you need to do is contact the New England Innocence Project at Testa Hurwitz and Tebow. So I did that, and I contacted NEEP, and they sent me the 26-page questionnaire, which I had to fill out again. And then they asked me for all my thing I've ever filed, so I got to send them another 1,200 pages of stuff. And then all of a sudden, a lawyer shows up, and, well, I'm heading back to the block, and the lawyer says, Maher, you having an attorney visit? I said, I haven't had an attorney in 15, 16 years. He says, well, you do now. So I went up and I met with Aliza Kaplan and Karen Burns. As you can imagine, I was quite emotional because this is my hopes and dreams coming together. And so we start talking and introducing ourselves. And then Aliza says to me, who's the cop in the trap? I says, I don't know why. She says, well, when we came in, he asked who we were. We told him Aliza Kaplan and Karen Burns. He goes, where are you from? And we said, the New England Innocence Project. And he goes, who are you here to see? And they said, Dennis Maher. And the guard said, it's about time. If anyone in here is innocent, it's Dennis. So that was her introduction to me. So they accepted the case, and they start looking for evidence, and Karen's calling the courthouse, and she's calling the police station. They tell them that the evidence has been destroyed or lost. She says, well, do you have records of this being destroyed or lost? And I said, no. So Karen got really frustrated at Cambridge Courthouse, and she went knocking on doors asking for help, and she found a clerk to help her. Now, this clerk went down into the evidence room and found the evidence. And so Aliza calls me and says, we found the evidence. And she says, well, you're not too excited. I says, well, I've had so many downs that if something really good happens, then I'll get excited. But we're sending it to Dr. Blake out in California, who's one of the foremost forensic scientists in the country. But he's not accepted by the government because he hates the government. And so they sent that to him, and then they came in to take my blood. So they bring me down to HSU, and they start talking to me, and then in walks someone from the DA's office, someone from the AG's office, an attorney for me, Karen Burns, the superintendent of the prison, the inner perimeter security people, and a phlebotomist. So they did the chain of evidence. They took my blood, took pictures of it, took a mouth swab, took pictures of that, handed the evidence to a state trooper who went back to the police lab, handed it to the chemist who got on a plane and hand-delivered it to Dr. Blake. Because she didn't want to do the testing because the evidence was so old in the Lowell cases. And so now I have to wait. So on Christmas Eve 2002, Aliza said to call her. So I called her. Now, she had moved from the New England Innocence Project to New York. Mm-hmm. I called her about 25 times, and there was no answer. And so I went outside to cool off, you know, because she told me to call her on Christmas Eve. And so I went back in, and the block officer says, "Mayor, call your attorney." I said, "I've been calling her all day." So finally I call her, and I get a hold of her. And I said, "Where have you been?" She says, "Oh, we were out celebrating." I said, "Why?" She goes, "We got two test results back today, and the DNAs didn't match. But they had to talk to the victims because they had to find out if the victim had sex with their boyfriend or whatever the night before. So now Martha Coakley's got to go talk to the victim after 19 years and tell her she may have sent an innocent man to prison." So they went and talked, and she was freaked out, which I don't blame her. You know, 19 years, you... on top of being raped, now you're being told you may have sent an innocent man to prison. That's got to be devastating. So they went and saw her a second time, and she was still freaked out. But she gave him permission to get the hospital records, which can only be gotten through a court order or permission from the victim. So they gave her permission, and it ended up that she was a virgin when she was raped. So now I'm cleared of the Lowell cases. My 20 to 30 year sentence is going to be gone. And I have the air case. So they start looking for the air evidence. And they're getting the same runaround. We don't know where the evidence is. The evidence has been destroyed. The evidence has been lost. And so Martha Coakley called Aliza and said, "Do you want to make a deal? We'll give him time served." And Aliza says, "No." And had some choice words from Martha Coakley that we're going to prove he's innocent. And all of a sudden, a slide shows up on Martha Coakley's desk from the case that they've been looking for. So they sent the slide to Marilyn to be tested. So I called Aliza on April Fool's Day. And I said, "Hi." And she says, "When do you want to go home?" This is April Fool's Day.
Yeah, the universe has a strange sense of humor. So go ahead.
She says, "No, when do you want to go home?" The test came back, and there were two different DNAs on it, and neither one of them was yours. I says, "Wow." I says, "Well, you better make it Thursday because it's going to take my parents at least a day to adjust." And so I called my parents and told them. My mother says, "I'm not going to be in the courtroom." So I called back later on, and she says, "I might be in the courtroom." And then I called her the night before I was going to court and said, and she goes, "I'll be there." So on April 3rd, 2003, I got my last strip search. Went to a Cambridge courthouse in Boston. Now, the Zakin Bridge had just opened. Traffic was a nightmare because all the roads were dirt and everything else. We get to the courthouse. They put me in a two-man cell, and they had the tank on the right side. And there's a guy in there whining that he's getting a 3 to 5. So I told him, "Well, will you shut up? I'm going home after doing 19 years, and I'm proven innocent." I never heard another peep out of him. So I went up to the courtroom. Aliza reads her motion. I had told her, I said, "You need to file a motion to get rid of the civil sentence." She says, "Why?" I said, "Just do it." So she files all the motions. Martha Coakley says, "We're not going to oppose this." The judge says, "All I have to do is sign this and he can go home." And he said, "Yeah." She says, "Well, I'm signing, he can leave." So I went back in, they took the ankle chains off, they took the waist chains off, and they let me go. I walked out the first door and met with my parents. Went to the second door and met with my brothers and friends. Walked out the third door into 5 TV cameras, about 15 microphones. And of course, their first question was, "How do you feel?" You know, and to say, "How do you think I feel?" And here comes Aliza, and she says, "Well, there's going to be a press conference at Tester Hurwitz and Tebow at noontime, and we'll see you all there." And then as I was leaving, the senior court officer comes over and says, "J.W. Carney would like to speak with you."
That's the prosecutor.
Yeah, the former prosecutor. And so we met in the hallway, and he apologized and asked for forgiveness. So I forgave him. which had a huge effect on me because I'm not angry. You know, I'm not bitter. Afterwards, Jay told me that if I didn't forgive him, he might have stopped being a lawyer. And it still affects him to this day. Because he told me he was in his office one day and Barry Scheck called him and said, Dennis Mayer's just been cleared in Lowell. He said, so I sat at my desk and cried. And he told me that he called him again and said, Dennis Mayer's going home Thursday. What I didn't know was that before I got there, he went and apologized to my parents and my brothers, which was, my brothers are still angry. And that's when I went home.
Alex, it's hard to say anything after hearing that story, but since we have you here, you can't get a better spokesman for the cause than Dennis. For people listening, what kind of insight can you bring?
Yeah, I mean, I guess I'll start at the end, which is with the prosecutor. You know, I think this is a very good case example because I think we become too focused on the rogue actor or focusing on that there are bad players in the system because those variables affect all systems and all walks of life. The prosecutor in this case clearly did the honorable thing. And I think that prosecutors, by and large, are honorable and are trying to do the right thing. And if you start with that premise rather than the premise of this is good versus evil in one direction or another, you start to be able to unwind where are the implicit biases in the system, where are the false positives, where are the errors. And this is a good example of that because I don't think he, knowing what I know, did this on purpose. And if you can get past that, I think you can look at it with a deeper lens. My other reaction, initial reaction, is this man is a hero and that the work that the Innocence Project is remarkable, not just for setting people free, but because it creates a system of checks and balances and creates good law and creates people asking the hard questions. But then at the end of the day, I go back to being a trial lawyer and I look at the facts of this case and there's only DNA in so many cases and only so many letters get read and only so many people can get exonerated. If everybody in the first instance would fight smart and hard for everybody accused of crimes, I think that that would create the best checks in the system. And, you know, hearing this case and going back, and I'll start with the man that Mr. Mayer is. You know, you can just tell that he's a good person by being around him. And he was a family man at the time, still living with his parents when most 20-year-olds weren't. He was a soldier when most of us wouldn't be. He had never been in trouble before when many of us had been. And I don't know if the story of him as a person was told, because when you think about it, he makes an awfully unlikely suspect if you really get into his humanity. And to the lawyers defending people and advocating on the ground, you have to look at that alibi and not just throw it into a courtroom, but really firm it up, because that could have, just like DNA can now, essentially prove innocence because of the metaphysical comment you made earlier. And I would have called other soldiers. I would have impressed the fact that while Flom might have a meeting where he shows up around 5, when military folks say that he didn't leave the base until 1720, that means 520, and it means precisely 520. And there's probably a logbook that could have been used to show what time he actually physically checked out. And then the next thing you know, it's not all the resources and the tears and the decades behind bars, it's an acquittal because he couldn't have done it. And so those are the things I focus on and that I come back to in the end.
But what do we do? Because I've always said that I believe most cops are good cops and most prosecutors are good prosecutors. But the ones that aren't, they wreck a path of destruction that is wide and big and devastating to so many people. But there are a number of systemic problems, right? I mean, it's easy for us to sit here and say, this is what should have been done. This is what could have been done. The system is stacked against Dennis, right? It was stacked against Dennis. It's stacked against guys like Dennis today. Somebody's being wrongfully convicted in America. Hopefully it's only one person, right? What can we do? What can people listening do to help prevent these things from happening, to prevent the next Dennis Mayer from ever having to go through this?
To me, it all goes back to the role of the prosecutor. There are tens of thousands of NYPD officers. You're going to have good ones. You're going to have bad ones. But the office that oversees them, which is a politically accountable office, are the offices of the district attorney. And when I say politically accountable, I don't mean to suggest that any of them are doing anything wrong. It's just they are political positions, and the will of the public and what people think and concerns people have certainly do influence those offices. And those offices have to serve as checks and balances not only on the police department, but on themselves. And it's very easy to put a lot into a case. The adversary process is competitive. You do want to win. You do think you are on the right side of things. And so it's easy to get caught up on that and not pause and say, are we sure? Not pause, especially after a jury says he's guilty, to not go back and look at it. And it can create a wall between accountability and the prosecutors, and a wall in a person's own mind that doesn't allow them to sort of self-assess and learn from these mistakes.
But there's so much more awareness now. It's at a peak, right? Now we see the rise of conviction integrity units. We're starting to see some public activism in terms of throwing bad prosecutors out of office, right? Because ultimately you can vote. And I think that's one sort of activism that's very simple. Dennis, before we sign off, and this is for you too, Hannah, you've spoken so eloquently and so powerfully about your experience, the tragedy, ultimately the triumph. The grace that you've shown is just sort of mind-blowing to me, and I'm sure to everyone who's listening. Is there anything else that either of you would like to share with our audience?
Sure. The vast majority of prosecutors and police are just human. You know, this is a human system. Like any other human system, there is going to be fault. And I find it really interesting that with other human-run systems, aviation and medicine are good examples, people expect mistakes to happen. So, you know, at a hospital, if a patient dies in somebody's care, they're going to have an M&M conference. They have all the people who worked on the case get together, and they pinpoint where a mistake was made. It's not blaming. It's saying you're a human. You did your best. Something went wrong. We're going to use this as a learning moment. And because of these things, the aviation field, the medical field have improved hugely. We don't really have something like that in the legal field right now. And Alex, maybe you can attest to this, but that lawyers and especially people who are going to go into prosecution are told you're going to wrongfully convict someone. You know, they're expected somehow to not be human, to not make mistakes. And when they do make mistakes, they're often covered up. It's seen as shameful. The incentives, justice is a moving target, and it's kind of an ethereal concept, whereas a conviction is something that you can count. It actually takes a pretty rare case to have enough evidence to be really foolproof. You know, we forget that obviously it's innocent until proven guilty. A lot of people think that even if you get to the point of a trial, like they must have done something to get there. And I think the fact that most cases don't have DNA, like we talked about, you know, the vast majority of wrongful convictions are probably people who were forced to take guilty pleas at a misdemeanor level.
Right. Dennis, I don't know that there's really, what could somebody add to what you've already said, but I want to turn it over to you to wrap up this episode of Wrongful Conviction.
Well, first I want to say hi to my kids and my wife.
Names?
Melissa, Joshua, and Eliza. She's named after the woman who got me out.
Wow.
What can people do to help? There are a lot of bills in its different states that are trying to get passed. They can call their politician, or they can go on the State House website and look up the bills and talk about that and tell them that they want to get behind it so that their senators or representatives would vote to make changes. You know, there's preserving evidence. We already changed witness identification in Massachusetts, which I was involved with. And things like that that can help. You know, I do a lot of public speaking. I speak at colleges. I'm going to go speak at a high school next week.
How can people reach you if they want you to come and speak? Do you have a website? Do you have a contact that you want to share with the audience?
Honestly, if you want to have Dennis come to anything, you can email me directly because I would love to make that happen.
What's your email?
hriley@newenglandinnocence.org.
And that's R-I-L-E-Y.
R-I-L-E-Y.
Okay, Dennis, well, all I can say is I really appreciate you being here. Same for you, Alex and Hannah. It's been an extraordinary experience being with you. All I can tell you is we'll never stop fighting. You give us just more and more inspiration from just being yourself. So keep being you.
Don't forget to give us a fantastic review wherever you get your podcasts. It really helps. And I'm a proud donor to the Innocence Project, and I really hope you'll join me in supporting this very important cause and helping to prevent future wrongful convictions. Go to innocenceproject.org to learn how to donate and get involved. I'd like to thank our production team, Connor Hall and Kevin Wardis. The music in the show is by 3-time Oscar-nominated composer, Jay Ralph. Be sure to follow us on Instagram at Wrongful Conviction and on Facebook at Wrongful Conviction Podcast. Wrongful Conviction with Jason Flom is a production of Lava for Good Podcasts in association with Signal Company No. 1.